Good morning. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, 10 minutes past 8 o'clock now on this Tuesday, September the 18th. Here's how our guest, Robert Draper, starts his new book, Dead Certain. You can't possibly figure out the history of the Bush presidency until I'm dead. George W. Bush slipped a piece of cheese into his mouth. Let's order first. He took a quick glance at the day's menu prepared for him and his guest and saw nothing on it he cared for and announced to the steward, "I'll have a hot dog, a low-fat hot dog." Then he slapped down the menu and asked, "What's the purpose of this book?" Well, we'll talk about the purpose of the book with Robert Draper during this hour, and we will welcome your questions and reactions for him at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, in Madison, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Please include your first name and your community with your email. You may have seen Robert Draper or heard him on National Public Radio or seen him in various national interviews. His book getting a lot of attention because some pretty surprising revelations came out of his many interviews with President Bush that he was granted in recent years. Like you probably heard this admission that the president told him, "I do a lot of crying on this job." Or how he said that he found the White House a creepy place during his father's presidency, saw ghosts coming out of the wall. And he also, President Bush, that is, said he wanted to make some money to replenish the old coffers after leaving office, noting that he can make ridiculous money on the lecture circuit. So we'll talk about Robert Draper's access and interviews with the president and what he learned, and welcome your reactions and questions as well. Robert Draper is a national correspondent for GQ Magazine, former senior editor at Texas Monthly, and he is the author of several books, including the recently published Dead Certain, The Presidency of George W. Bush. Good morning.
Thanks for having me on your show.
Yeah, thanks a lot for being with us. I understand you're joining us from a hotel somewhere that has a crummy telephone, so we have you on your cell phone.
That's right, but I'll try not to step on your questions, and I think we'll be all right.
Yeah, it'll be fine. Just to explain the little bit of buzz that we hear in the back of the phone there. Well, Robert Draper, how did you manage this? How did you convince President Bush to let you write a book about him?
Well, it didn't happen instantly, that's for certain. I had spent a lot of time with Senator Bush when I was at Texas Monthly and later at GQ Magazine in the mid-90s while he was governor. And I did a lengthy profile on Bush in 1998 for GQ as he was planning to run for president. I spent a lot of time with him and with his family and his staff. And it was a very fair piece. I think that he felt like I got him in the piece. But I had no further contact with anybody in the Bush White House for many years thereafter. And I think that when I decided to do this book in the latter part of 2004, a lot of other reporters had been cowed by the secretiveness of the administration and grown frustrated with their attempts to gain access to the administration. And so what happened, much to my surprise, was that when I decided to do an even-tempered biography that would cover the totality of Bush's administration, his presidency, I found that I had the field all to myself, and I sort of went about my business attempting to interview various people in the West Wing, and over a period of a couple of years proved largely successful. I think the president noticed this. People were coming back to him and telling him that Draper seems to be doing a thorough job and an even-handed job, doesn't seem to be grinding any axes. And so by August of last year, well into my research, I should say, and indeed well into the writing of my book, I was granted an off-the-record summit with the president in the Oval Office, in which he gave me sort of the opportunity to plead my case. And he wanted to know how this book would be different from other books, why he should cooperate with me. And I must have convinced him, though not immediately. He said he would reflect on it after our talk, and indeed he did for about three more months. Then he agreed to do one interview in the middle of December, the only one, and his counselor Dan Bartlett said, we'll see how it goes. At the end of that interview, which you quoted some from, since that's the prologue of my book, the president stood up and said, okay, we'll do another. And we did indeed, and that led ultimately to six interviews.
Mm-hmm. So what did you tell him when he asked you over hot dogs? What is the purpose of this book?
Well, I essentially reiterated what I'd told him in August, which was that it was intended to be a first draft of history, that I didn't intend to judge the man. I would leave that to somebody 50 years from now to do so, and someone, in other words, after George W. Bush was dead. But I intended instead for this book to be sort of an even-handed narrative of his presidency, and in particular to focus on the president himself, you know, to operate under the assumption, which many people have not operated under, that the president is the engine driving his presidency, that he's not a passive observer to it, that he hasn't farmed it out to Dick Cheney, Karl Rove, and others, and to capture him as a sort of literary character, thus as a means of describing how events have occurred in his administration.
Yeah, and he's not dumb.
No, he's not. And I think that in a way, that caricature of him has served him well. I think he has literally made a living off of being, as he would put it, misunderestimated by his foes. It's easy for some to come away with that impression of Bush, given that he almost cheerfully mangles the English language, given his insistence that he doesn't read what's written about him, given his seemingly native stubbornness. But in fact, I've found the president to be a great deal more complicated than that, and certainly more intelligent. In one-on-one sessions, not only I, but almost anyone who's been in the West Wing, who's worked in the West Wing, could tell you that if you're having a discussion with the president and you don't have your argument together, he will eviscerate you. Not in a bullying way, but he's very good at getting to the logical heart of the matter, and ultimately pulling it apart if it doesn't have its own integrity. He also is a voracious reader, though he claims that he doesn't read the papers, that's really not true. He doesn't read editorials, but he does read newspapers. And he reads lots of books, and these aren't exactly coloring books either. I mean, he reads serious history books. He and I talked about the novel No Country for Old Men by Cormac McCarthy that he'd read and enjoyed very much. So there's a lot that's surprising intellectually about the president.
Yeah. The title, Dead Certain, pertains to his stubbornness, his what?
Well, I think it pertains to one of the core aspects of him and thus of his presidency, which is a certitude. Which, you know, on a good day, in a good moment, and viewed from certain angles, can present itself as a virtue, as steadfastness. I think the nation drew a lot of strength from and comfort from the president after September 11th. His focus, his clarity of vision, that was a level of certitude that served him and the nation well. on other days, and viewed from other angles, that certitude can come off as stubbornness, as obstinacy. And so I think that aspect reflects something I find interesting about the president, which is that his virtues and his vices are sort of one and the same. Now, I didn't call it certain, I called it dead certain, and the reason I did was because I think there's another aspect to this president, the one of adamance, of almost of protesting too much, of saying I'm not only certain, I'm dead certain. And so the title reflects the doubt that has sprung up against this president and his administration, the credibility gap that has surfaced as a result of the president saying things that may be at variance with realities on the ground. And so I wanted the title to reflect that irony as well.
Yeah. And this president doesn't express regrets very openly, did he, to you?
No, it's interesting you should ask, because during my 6 hours or so of interviews with the president, he was very emotionally honest. You referenced earlier him talking about the crying that he mm-hmm. does on the job. He has a great sense of humor. He can be very reflective. He can be prickly. He can be gracious. And I saw all of these. The interviews in total were sort of emotional tour de force. What I did not see was ruefulness. What I did not see was regret. In part, I think that's a function of the president's unwillingness to show any member of the media. He's not going to go to the media to do his confessions. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, the president made clear to me that he does not like to show doubt in front of his own staff. He said that he doesn't want his staff to become dismayed, to lose any sense of mission. And so he makes a point of evincing optimism, if only to buck up those around him. So it's clear that it's not it's not something the president does. And indeed, I think one of the most surprising aspects of this presidency I found in my research was to find just how difficult it was for his aides in the West Wing to get the president to admit publicly that mistakes had been made in Katrina and in Iraq, that they had to, as I put it in the book, ratchet up the humility slowly, ratchet down the triumphalism slowly, as if they were introducing chemotherapy in a patient's body and hoping not to cause shock to the system. This, in other words, the voicing of regret is far from a reflexive thing in this president.
We are talking about the presidency of George W. Bush with Robert Draper, who has written a biography called Dead Certain. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. We welcome your thoughts and questions for him. Robert Draper, a national correspondent for GQ magazine, a former senior editor at Texas Monthly, who was granted unprecedented access and a number of interviews with George W. Bush in this, what he calls a first draft of history of the presidency of George W. Bush. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Happy to have you along. Hope you stay tuned. Coming up this afternoon, it's At Issue with Ben Marins between 4 and 6 this afternoon. After 5, Ben will talk with two guests on different sides of the debate over the Video Competition Act, which is a bill in the state legislature that some say will increase cable competition, others say it will curb it. The latest on the Video Competition Act coming up after 5 o'clock this afternoon. We are happy to have with us Robert Draper. He is author of Dead Certain, The Presidency of George W. Bush, and we will welcome your questions for him at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Lots of inside information inside the White House and inside the presidency of George W. Bush. The book has received a tremendous amount of national attention, Robert Draper, and we talked a little bit about one revelation that you revealed in the book about the president saying, "I do a lot of crying on this job." What makes him cry? Was it the war? Was it the stress? What makes him cry on the job?
Joy, he was specifically referring to the sessions that he has, and he's had many of them, with families of the fallen, with wounded soldiers. He recognized really before he went into war, because Andy Card had talked to him about this, his then chief of staff. Card had served as deputy chief of staff for his father, and recognized that one of the inevitabilities of being a commander-in-chief, being a war president, is that you're going to have to spend time consoling those individuals whose children or whose loved ones have died in conflict. And the president has done so, and he makes a point whenever he's in a town that has a military base of scheduling a visit to a military hospital so he can visit the wounded. He has literally visited thousands of grieving individuals. And these sessions have been very interesting. You know, a lot of congressmen go to do these same things, and they tend, they've often come back to the president and said, you know, that every time I go to these hospitals and talk to grieving widows, they get in my face and they say, bring the troops home now. The president told me he doesn't have that experience nearly as much. He's had it a few times, but for the most part, they tend, when he shows up to comfort them, they tend to comfort him. He said the healer gets healed. He said that they often will say to him, don't let my son die in vain. Finish the mission. And the president made a point of pointing that out to me on at least a half a dozen different occasions, saying to me, I often hear the voices of those families. And it was clear to me that he's emboldened by that remark. Now, I that's something of a double-edged sword. While one could completely understand the human component of someone who's lost a loved one in combat, saying to the president, please give me assurance that this was for a reason. Please finish the mission. I'm not certain that one would want to drive policy from that, and I'm not suggesting that the president does it solely from that. But it is striking to me that it stays in his mind, in his consciousness, what these people have said to him, and does lead one to the conclusion that it is influenced in part his determination to see things through in Iraq.
Tom in Fond du Lac is our first caller. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Good morning. I'm just wondering if the guest ever had the sense that the president might feel that he's been duped by people around him.
That's an interesting question. Thanks for it, Tom. Mm-hmm. Again, the president is loath to, and I think this is further to the notion that the president's virtues and vices are one and the same. He's loath to dwell on mistakes made. He doesn't let things stew in him. It's one reason why people love working for him, that he's loyal to them despite the fact that they may have screwed up. And this by way of saying that no, he never indicated to me that Rove or Cheney or Gonzalez or Rumsfeld or Bremer or others may have let him down. Indeed, when we talked about the matter of disbanding the Iraqi army and of debathification, two things that Ambassador Paul Bremer did on the ground, despite policies that had been decided before he arrived in Iraq. The president really didn't want to dwell on finger pointing or on mistakes made. I do know that he resents the notion that any of these scenarios would suggest that somehow he didn't have his hands on the steering wheel. The Washington Post did a very revealing, I think really excellent, series of stories a few months ago called The Angler about Vice President Cheney, in which it was in which the premise was basically that while Bush is the decider, Cheney decides the menu from which the decider decides. The president, according to someone I know in the West Wing, was infuriated by that series of stories. He didn't dispute its content. He just hated the premise. The premise being that he somehow wasn't in charge and was duped by Cheney. That having been said, I don't see any evidence that it's affected his dynamics with the vice president. So I think the president clings at times stubbornly to the belief that he and his subordinates have done the right thing, and to the extent that they haven't, he refuses to dwell on it.
Yeah. You reveal in the book that Karl Rove did not want Bush to select Dick Cheney as his running mate?
Yes, I thought that was a remarkable thing. Remarkable because Rove's reasoning was fairly sound, on top of the obvious that Cheney's state, Wyoming, was already Republican, only mm-hmm. dealt three electoral votes. More to the point, Dick Cheney was a George Herbert Walker Bush man. He had been Secretary of Defense under the first Bush administration. And part of their mission, Team Bush's mission in 2000, was to emphasize to voters that George W. Bush was his own man, wasn't taking marching orders from Daddy. Picking Cheney would send the opposite message. However, the president ignored that advice, and I think that what seemed to have greater what he had greater appreciation for was first that Cheney had a wealth of experience and could sort of cover his flank, Bush's flank in foreign policy. But just as much, and the president pointed this out to me, he said he didn't want it. He didn't want the job. Cheney didn't want the number two job. And that was important to this president. And I think is a telling aspect of sort of Exhibit A of the insecurity that still rustles around in Bush. After all, Clinton, for all of his shortcomings, found plenty of use out of Al Gore as his number two guy, despite the fact that it was no secret that Al Gore had designs on the number one seat. Clinton didn't feel threatened by that. Bush, on the other hand, did by the prospect of a politically ambitious vice president. And so instead he picked a man who would have no agenda other than Bush's.
Yeah. And what can you tell us about, Tom was wondering if the president felt duped by his staff. Did the president talk to you at all about whether he to this day thought that WMDs were in Iraq and the whole faulty intelligence that led to us going into Iraq?
Well, he's on the subject of WMDs, I asked him directly whether he still believed that to this day that Saddam Hussein had in fact possessed them. I asked him that question because Andy Card had told me on the record that at the time of Card's resignation as chief of staff in April of 2006, both he and the president still believed that Saddam had possessed WMDs. The president was evasive on the subject. He didn't say yes and he didn't say no. What he's emphasized with respect to the faulty intelligence was that that this was not just intelligence presented to him, but intelligence presented to Blair, to Howard, and to everyone else in the world, that this was a failure on the part of international intelligence. So, you know, again, this I found early on, Joy, that with the president, that to try to play a game of gotcha or to try to pin him down where he simply wouldn't be pinned down was not a useful exercise. I mean, people tend to reveal themselves when you create a comfort zone for them. That's especially true for this president, who really, really requires comfort. Mm-hmm. There were a few questions that I asked him, you know, relating to the decision by Bremer to reverse policy on disbanding the Army, why bipartisanship had suffered under his administration, that that we sort of went round and round on, and that ultimately he gave interesting answers to. Same with his decision to get rid of Rumsfeld when he did. But by and large, I found that trying to get the president to own up to mistakes was ultimately a counterproductive ordeal.
Yeah, he had you talk about a room full of senior advisors raising hands as to whether Rummy should stay or go.
Yes, that was that took place in April of 2006, and the predicate laid for this was that many people in the West Wing had been agitating for some time for the Secretary of Defense to be given his walking papers. Really, going back to 2004, close advisors to the president had believed that Rumsfeld was increasingly becoming a liability to the administration. But one thing after another would cause the president to dig in his heels. At a meeting that you've just mentioned in the residence of the White House in April of 2006, a number of the president's closest advisors were brought in to just discuss what to do about the state of the administration at that point, which was not in a good way. The subject of Rumsfeld came up, and it was suggested that that Rumsfeld be fired. And the president asked for people to raise their hands as to whether or not the secretary should stay or go, and to explain their reasoning. And they did so. The vote was 7-4 for getting rid of Rumsfeld. Of the four, the president was among them. But of course, his was the vote that counted, and Rumsfeld stayed for several more months.
Yeah. And let's go back to the phones. Alex in Milwaukee, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning, Joy, and hello to the guest. I'm not surprised by the guest observation of President Bush. I'm fascinated with the topic, and I've tried to get some understanding of what drives President Bush's behavior myself. Now, with the caveat that I don't have the president here and I have not interviewed him myself, one issue in Bush's personal history that stands out is his alcohol use. He admitted that his alcohol use was serious, but eventually he was able to stop drinking, and he gets full marks for that. But Bush is an untreated alcoholic. He stopped after a long, long period of use, and the kind of drinking, the kind of motivation and thinking process that drives that kind of alcohol use is still there and hasn't been really addressed in any kind of meaningful way that I can tell from afar. the best example.
Yeah, well, Alex, I'm trying to get to the point of your call, besides pointing out that the president drank a lot in his past.
Well, the best example of that is the split in his thinking. People in situations are right-wrong, left-right, up-down, you're with me, you're against me, you're a patriot, you're a traitor, nothing in between. He's dead certain.
Yeah. Well, did this come up in any way, shape, or form in your interviews, Robert Draper? Do you think that this influences his decisions that he makes?
Well, it's an excellent observation, and yes, it did. The president brought it on his own. He said in my very first interview with him in December of 2006 that he didn't believe that he would have still been that he'd be able to be president if he were still drinking. Mm-hmm. He also said he just volunteered this. That he said, you know, it's funny. I haven't had a drink in 20 years, and I can still remember what a hangover feels like. His wife had told me before that the quote was, "George does pretty much everything to excess, and alcohol is one of those things that's not good to do to excess." And so I think the caller is correct that he still has. I resisted putting Bush on the couch, so to speak, in this book. But it's impossible to ignore that this man, as his wife says, attempts to do excessive things or things to excess. He's traded in a serious addiction, I think, for a much more benign one, and that's exercise. And the book is rife with details of the extremes to which he goes in his exercise regimen. And indeed, the attention that he focuses on it, attention which he doesn't necessarily focus on other aspects of his presidency.
Interesting. And it's
the Secret Service, as I mentioned, the book would go to great extremes to placate him on the subject of his exercise. They would hunt out biking trails for him. They would, in some cases, build biking trails at taxpayers' expense, both in the Secret Service Academy in Maryland and on his own ranch. And this, you know, became the kind of thing that the president would covet and would rely on the way he had perhaps relied on alcohol in the past.
Thank you, Alex, for the call. Roger in Lake Moore, Illinois. Hi, you're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you. As someone who is not a fan of this administration, I don't know, I'm kind of torn between being pleased and disappointed that there seems to be more depth to the man than there seems to be on the surface. But my question is, one thing that has troubled me is his demeanor. I don't see him as having a presidential or statesman-like demeanor. And I wonder if his image that he wants to give off, if you think that's part of his certitude, his stubbornness, or kind of relating to the last caller, kind of the excess to which he will go.
Well, I do think that the president has done well politically by presenting an image of a guy whose charms are of the scruffy variety. You know, he sort of is who he is, and I don't think that's calculation. I mean, there he was seeing a reporter, me, in the room next to the Oval Office over lunch, pounding a hot dog down his face in record time, with breadcrumbs falling from his face. This is a man who he's fairly unvarnished, he's certainly aware of that. He's tried to turn that virtue into a vice, and I think that in certain parts of the country and in certain there are lots of folks who look at him and say he's one of us, and in turn will feel some sympathy towards him when he's derided by the press. He does at the same time uphold the dignity or attempt to of the White House. Decorum is very important to him. For example, he and Andy Card made the decision before he stepped into the Oval Office for the first time that anyone who did walk into it must wear a coat and tie. That's at variance with the way things were in the Clinton administration. He believes in the sanctity, as it were, of the presidency, of the office, and so you know, it's not as if he has turned by any means the White House into a frat house. To the extent that he does not uphold the proper image of what a president ought to be. Obviously, that's in the eyes of the beholder. His informality has rubbed people the wrong way, particularly when he's gone on foreign trips and is seen massaging the back of Merkel and sort of chatting in an almost big dog way towards Blair. It can be unsettling to some. That, unfortunately, is the nature of the man.
Thank you, Roger. Annalisa in Green Bay is with us now. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks very much for this interview. I mean, I think it gives some depth to this president who's so often caricatured, and even though I'm not a big fan, I'm not a fan at all of his policies. I have a couple of questions about his relationship with his father. Did you get any sense of that? There's been a lot written about that. And also, what is his relationship with his wife, Laura? Thanks.
Sure. Yeah, those are, thanks for that question. Those are obviously two very key relationships. The second one with his wife, quite uncomplicated and straightforward. The first one, very loving but extremely complicated. And so I'll start with the one with his father. It's almost a classic. A classical element, or template, the eldest son of a famous father, spending his youth and early adulthood both trying to measure up to what feels like an impossible standard and trying to differentiate himself from that standard and be his own man. What's remarkable about President Bush is how well into his adulthood, all the way up to the present, he still feels the need to differentiate himself from his dad, and in so doing, to sort of posit himself as the superior model. Now, I want to be clear, the two have a very, very loving relationship. There's no question about that. At the same time, just in one of my interviews with Bush, he was talking about this think tank of his presidential library that he intended to found, the Freedom Institute. And he said, I'm going to raise $500 million for it. And then he immediately said after that, Dad raised $300 million for his. Mm-hmm. And it just struck, the book has many examples of the president almost as a nervous tic or something, having to explain to people how he's different from his dad, even putting his dad down now and again. In my first interview with the president, he mentioned that his ability to think on his feet. And he mentioned that when his dad was president and was at a press club engagement, somebody asked him, "How come you're wearing a red tie, Mr. President?" And he was momentarily tongue-tied. And the son, Bush, whispered into 41's ear, "Tell him that's because you spilled gravy on your blue tie." And that's exactly what his dad did. He got a big laugh. And then, as George W. Bush reported to me, and then what does my dad do? He tells the press, "My son just gave me that line." It's typical George Herbert Walker Bush, refusing to get the credit. But he said it in a way that was both admiring and a little bit derisive, like that it was sort of politically naive, that his dad had missed an opportunity. So that's a real interesting aspect of this presidency. And I should, one more thing before I get on to Mrs. Bush. I asked Bush in that first interview, "Mr. President, we all know about that colloquy you had with Bob Woodward over whether you talked to your dad before you invaded Iraq, and you said, 'I appeal to a higher father.' Now, that was a great line, but Mr. President, surely you didn't mean that. Your dad has a lot of experience on the subject of wars, of Iraq, and on Saddam Hussein in particular. Surely you discussed it with him." And he said, "No, I did not." He said, "That's not the way our relationship works. I don't say what would you do if you were me, Dad. But if there's a specific thing, I'll ask him, or I want to know, like you've had experience with Gates, Dad. What do you think of the man? Then I'll do so." I think that he didn't ask about what his dad thought about whether or not he should invade Iraq, because he knew what his dad's answer would be, which would probably be the answer that Baker and Scowcroft provided. Now, to Laura Bush, they have a very, very loving relationship, and she is not a policymaker. Occasionally she will weigh in, and when she does, her opinions are certainly heard. But she is there sort of to provide him with the comfort zone he seeks. They didn't discuss, for example, the buildup to going to war in Iraq, she told me. Instead, she would watch him pace out on the south lawn, and then he'd come inside, have dinner with her, they'd get in bed, they'd put Barney the dog on the bed, they'd get their books out and read. And that, to her, she said was sort of the the comfort zone that she would help provide him.
We are talking with Robert Draper. He is author of Dead Certain, The Presidency of George W. Bush. We have an open line if you want to ask a question about the presidency of George W. Bush. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Robert Draper, a national correspondent for GQ magazine, was granted 6 interviews with President Bush over the past few years, and he reports a lot of surprising admissions from the chief executive in his book, with his unlimited or unprecedented access to the president and staff and the White House. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Stay tuned. Kathleen Dunn is with you after 9 o'clock. Senator Hillary Clinton is the latest candidate to unveil her health care plan. In the run-up to the 2008 presidential election, Kathleen and her guest will examine the role of health care in the race for the White House coming up in our next hour. We're going inside the White House and inside the presidency of George W. Bush for the rest of this hour with the author of Dead Certain, Robert Draper. Before we go back to the phones, Robert Draper, one of the admissions or revelations that I found, maybe not the most important in the book, but interesting, is that Laura Bush didn't like Karl Rove very much and called him Pigpen.
Yes, that's right. We're talking about a woman here who is a very gentle soul, and she is loath to assign someone a nickname that might be perceived as hurtful. I don't want to suggest that she hated the man. She didn't. Her husband and Karl Rove are extremely close. But at the same time, I think that she viewed Rove as a kind of necessary evil. Mrs. Bush is not one to be a fan of the brass knuckles aspect of down and dirty politics. Nor is she one to be amused at all when others seem to be claiming the credit for things that her husband has accomplished. And she often felt that Rove had a tendency to do just that. And so she would say, Bush's brain has to say about that. She has friends in Texas politics, one in particular, House Speaker Pete Lamb, who was essentially dethroned from his post after a series of maneuvers that she believed Karl Rove was behind her. Other people did, and when she spoke to the Laneys about it, she was very apologetic to them. It was amongst those in the staff that she tolerated Rove because she didn't do, but that didn't mean she had to like the things he represented.
Yeah, and President Bush kind of bullied Karl Rove a little bit?
I'm sorry, say that again,
did he bully Karl Rove in treating... Like, there was a story you told about how he ordered Rove to go hang up his jacket or something along those lines?
Yeah, I think that they have very much an older brother, younger brother relationship, and Bush, being the big dog, like a lot of older brothers, seeks to put the younger brother in his place. Some of that is due to the fact that Rove would need to be put in his place. He tended to be a power grabber, tended to talk a lot, so much so that Josh Bolton stripped Rove of his policy portfolio because he tended to be the noisiest voice in meetings, and others were loath to talk when he was talking. But in addition to that aspect, I think the president, Rove tended to bring out certain insecurities in the president. The relationship was like the quarterback of the high school football team and the nerd who takes his term papers for him, and he sort of reminds him what he's not. And so, in this particular meeting that you're referencing, it was in 1999. Candidate Bush was surrounded by economic advisors. Rove was sort of carrying on and on. It was driving Bush nuts. And he said, "Carl, go hang up my coat." And everyone was startled. They thought, surely this is a joke. Surely we didn't hear what we think we just heard. But in fact, they did. And Rove glumly went and hung Governor Bush's coat up. It was clearly an example of putting Rove in his place.
Yeah. Chet in Oak Creek is with us. Hi, Chet. You're on the air.
Yes, I'm wondering if your guest would elaborate a little bit on how he feels that history will judge the president based on some recent stuff. I know Alan Greenspan came out with a scathing information about Bush and how he basically torched the economy. And then also, I know U.S. News and World Report a few months ago did a story, and I consider them pretty middle of the road, throwing out the possibility that he may be one of the worst presidents in history. I'll take the comments off the air.
Sure. Well, I've tried to stay out of the judgment game. I mean, that was kind of my pitch to the president, and I've held to it that it's really not for me to judge him. And I essentially buy his premise that it's not his legacy's not going to play itself out for decades to come. Now, having said that, there are certain things we can say without equivocation. He has presided over a very polarized environment, and I think it is fair to say that he has exacerbated that polarity. He promised to do otherwise, and that did not eventuate. I would predict as well that this president is not going to go down in history as an inconsequential president. For better or for worse, he will not be viewed as a mediocrity. He will instead be viewed either, as the caller has suggested, one of the worst presidents in history, or one of the most dynamic and monumental. So much of what his legacy hinges on has to do with how things shape up in Iraq. Mm-hmm. And at the moment, things seem to be stabilizing in certain areas, perhaps not in others. I don't think it's anywhere near the time to be rendering a verdict on that. But once that verdict has been issued, it will ultimately tell us writ large what the legacy of the Bush administration is.
Yeah. And while he says we won't know until he's dead, how important is it to him, his legacy?
Joy, that's a good question. I mean, I think that, you know, he's at peace with the fact that that there's only so much of it he can control, and that it's going to be rendered well after he's gone. But yeah, it's important to him. I mean, he wants to do big things. He wants to affect the world in a monumental and positive way. And he's at peace with the notion that right now he's unpopular, and he tells himself that's because that's fundamental to leadership. A leader is supposed to do tough things, and when you make people uncomfortable by changing the world, you're going to be unpopular as a result. It's why he spent a lot of time reading history books about people like Truman and Lincoln and Churchill, who did things that made them made the world around them uncomfortable, but who were ultimately acquitted by history. And I think the president is sanguine that the same thing will happen to him.
Ellis and Boaz is with us now. Hi, Ellis.
Hi, Joy and Robert. I've got a question. I saw the Woodward interview when he talked about consulting his higher father about the Iraq War. Do you think that George Bush thinks that he's doing the will of God, which would kind of explain his black and white confidence about the war in Iraq?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that question, because I actually there's no question that Bush is a man of faith. The question really has been whether is he messianic? Does he view himself as anointed by God as the chosen to be this crusader? And I think the answer is no. I think these are two different issues, really. That one of them is this: his seeing the world in black and white has to do with his certitude, has an element of petulance to it, this insistence that things must be a certain way. But I don't think that's because the Bible has guided him as such. I find no fault with the president on this. I think that he's a good Christian, and that he draws on the Bible and on his faith for strength, not for validation. I think that he consults God and the Bible in moments of humility, not in moments of pridefulness. So I think that the issues are separate. It's understandable why people would conflate the two, but there's nothing that I found in my conversations with him that would indicate that he felt himself to be appointed by God to change the world.
Thanks, Ellis. Buck in Madison is with us now. Hi, Buck.
I'd like to reiterate questions others have asked about the man's moral compass, right? If he's not a puppet, then he's witting. Personally, I think this administration is disposed to evil. But even if you don't accept that, would you speak about Bush's moral compass?
Well, sure. I mean, he's he believes he has one, and he believes he's guided by it, and he believes in particular that moral compass was jostled by the events of September 11th. I mean, it understands why people would be infuriated by the seeming conflation on the Bush administration's part of the events of 9/11 with going into Iraq, and how to this day it seems that the president is trying to draw a connection that isn't there. Here's where the connection lies, and it goes to the president's moral compass. He believes that the world, his world, America's world, changed after 9/11, and that we could no longer ignore malevolent actors. We were no longer safe. And I think the president felt a moral affront by the attacks on our nation on September 11th, and he then began to use very stark language of good versus evil. I think that a lot of Americans were quite comfortable with that after September 11th, and over time they came to be less so, particularly when our own fallibilities began to emerge in the prosecution of Iraq and in what followed. Abu Ghraib revelations regarding torture at Guantanamo and the so-called enhanced interrogation techniques. Nonetheless, I think, you know, the president does have this sort of moral certitude and does consult his compass. I don't know what to say about the aspect of I personally don't agree that the president represents evil. I do, as a my own sort of personal philosophy, believe that we all have the capacity for good, and we all have the capacity as decent people nonetheless to commit indecencies.
Talk some about what the president wants to do when he leaves office. Much has been made that he wants to make ridiculous money on the leisure circuit.
Yeah, I'm sure he regrets having said that to me, though I must say that for whatever else one thinks of the president, he's not a greedy man, and it was not the first thing out of the gate, the first thing out of his mouth when I asked him, what are you going to do when you retire? He talked at great length about this Freedom Institute that he wants to build, his presidential library where young Democratic leaders of struggling democracies can come to learn more about democratic processes. He spoke at length about that, and then he sort of paused and said, you know, I'll probably replenish the old coffers, go on the lecture circuit. I think the context in which he was talking about this was not, boy, I really want to make some money, but that his dad was doing it, that Clinton was doing it, and it was sort of de rigueur for former presidents to do it. There was an element of competition, I think, there and Bush is a very competitive guy, that these guys are making a bunch of money, I'll bet I can go do the same. And I think that the president was very conscious when he did these interviews with me that my book was going to be published when it was going to be published. He often asked me when I'd ask him a question, now, when's this book going to be published again? And then he would choose to answer or not to answer in accordance with that reality. But at this particular juncture, when I was talking to him about retirement, I think the veil kind of slipped away. He was less conscious of the fact that this book would be published while he was still president, and he said what he said, which I'm sure he now regrets. But again, I don't think that it was that we should take from it that the guy's a jealous man or a greedy man.
Right. And in 30 seconds, I know there's been a little bit of quibble from like Andrew Card saying, "Oh no, it didn't happen that way." Have you had any reaction from President Bush himself to the book?
No, not from the president, and the White House has been steadfast in its no comments. I've heard from a lot of people who left the West Wing over the last couple of years, and they've been overwhelmingly effusive in what they've said. Andy Card pointed out a couple of small errors that I made, and I'm glad to know about them, and we'll correct them.
Thank you so much for being with us. It's been interesting. Thanks very much.
My pleasure, Joy.
Robert Draper, author of Dead Certain, The Presidency of George W. Bush. Thanks to Carmen Jackson and Leo Duran for producing the hour. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.